Hello. I'm a bit nervous about this, actually, because although I'm used to standing and talking in front of people, being a teacher, I think giving your testimony feels a lot more vulnerable because when you're giving your testimony, I'm sure all of you who've given your testimony probably will agree, there's something very vulnerable about the fact that you're basically admitting to failure and you're speaking of God's success. So the mask has to come off and I have to basically admit to you a lot of things about me that I really would rather not have to admit to you. So I'll try my best to be honest and sort of appropriate in what I say. And I'll try to be faithful to what God has done in my life. And I am really, really grateful for that. So I really hope that comes across, if nothing else does. And I was thinking quite a lot about what I feel that really, what some of the big themes are that God's brought into my life and the way that he's changed and shaped the way I think about things. And one of a really big theme, something that I treasure a lot and have thought about a lot in my life, is wisdom and knowledge. And so my testimony tonight, I want the overall theme to be for me to share with you how my perception of what wisdom and knowledge is has changed, the way that has changed over my life. So I'll try and explain that for you now. So just to give you a bit of background, I was born in York. I very, very quickly, even as a small child, I just loved thinking about things. I was brought up in a family that was really keen on thinking about things. my dad is an academic at university. My mum's a teacher. And they really, really encouraged me to share my thoughts as well. So I was brought up believing it was okay to have your own opinion. And in fact, it was welcomed if you had original thoughts about things. We were a very verbal family. We talked a lot together. So I loved the idea of pursuing truth. I just loved it. I was really interested in lots of things. And I was also the oldest in my family. I had two younger sisters and a brother. And I think I actually quite enjoyed that. I quite enjoyed being bossy, to be quite honest with you. I liked telling people what to do. I think it gave me a feeling of... if I'm honest, I think it gave me a feeling of power, but also I think it made me feel useful because I enjoyed if one of my little brothers or sisters came up to me and said, Emily, I don't understand this. I actually really enjoyed saying, oh, I can help you with that, and talking to them about it. So you could say I didn't have much to challenge me at that point. I had a very secure place to grow up in. I enjoyed telling people what to do quite a lot, and I have taught some of you in here, and you might say nothing's changed, I don't know. But so I was encouraged to be very independent and be an original thinker at an early age. And although I really liked playing games and I liked being with... I did enjoy fun and being with friends and family. I was also quite a dreamer and I spent quite a lot of time... I used to really enjoy spending time on my own as well. I used to go off for walks and make stories up to myself. And I was basically that dreamy kid in the corner of the classroom that's not really listening to what the teacher's saying and is in their own world a lot of the time. And I had very definite ideas about what I wanted, so it didn't bother me if what I was thinking didn't match the status quo of what everyone else was expecting. Just to give you an idea of that, my mum delights... I don't actually remember this, but my mum delights in telling me about this story of when I was in a PE lesson at school when I was about apparently five, and the PE teacher said, Emily, would you like to show everybody the forward roll that you've just been doing on the mat? And apparently I stood up and said, no, but I am going to sing you a song. and that was what I was like. As someone who's a teacher now, I have to say that makes me cringe slightly because I know what it's like when somebody says that. I enjoyed school. I liked schoolwork. It wasn't something I suppose it was something that I threw myself into and I just enjoyed it. So how did that fit into what was happening spiritually? Well, I suppose because I was in a secure environment, I felt very free to discuss Christianity. I was never made to feel that it was wrong to debate Christianity or to ask questions about it. And I actually think that's what helped me to accept the truth of it at quite a young age. I think if I'd been told I could never question anything, it would have had the opposite effect. I'm really deeply grateful for my parents because I can really say that they modelled the the character of God to me in the way that they were as people. So they made it very easy for me to believe in a very dependable Heavenly Father. My mum was, she was very creative and she had a real sense of fun and wonder, or she pretended she did anyway. And that really made me feel that God was a creator who enjoyed fun and had created this beautiful world that was full of amazing things to explore. And I loved that. And that was part of knowledge and wisdom as well, the idea that there's loads to find out about things. I just loved that idea. And my mum, I believe, was the one who really instilled that in me. And my earliest memories are to do with spending time with her. I guess it's because I was the oldest, so we had a lot of time to spend together. And my dad was, I felt he was a very solid, dependable person. And again, I'm really, really grateful to him because I knew that he was really, really busy. He was often at work very late. But actually, if something happened in the family, he would immediately drop everything and run. He would just go. It was just like his instinct. And I remember being really deeply grateful for that and thinking, if this is what my earthly father's like, then the Heavenly Father that they're teaching me about must be even more like this. And I remember that he was somebody that students at university used to come to if they were in trouble. He was quite a pastoral teacher. And I remember one day he went off looking for a student that had gone missing at the university. They were very deeply upset and disturbed, and he'd just gone off to try and find them. They'd gone off in the North York Moors or something, having a bit of a breakdown. And I remember thinking, I'm so glad my dad's like that. And it just made me really grateful. And it made me, and I felt he modelled to me that God is like that. You know, he goes out and he pursues us. So all of this, you know, it gave me the sense that God was my father. In a way, I would say it was a bit back to front because I felt so secure in my family upbringing. I think I had a sense of God as my father before I had an awareness of God as my saviour. So it was a little bit back to front, I suppose. It was quite topsy-turvy. And I actually had a problem with sin. I found it difficult to understand. I was actually just quite a proud child, to be honest. I found Sunday school teaching confusing. So, for example, in Sunday school, people would say things like, okay, so Jesus died on the cross to save you from your sin. Now, what is sin, children? You know, oh, yeah, that's right. It's things like stealing biscuit from a tin when your mum isn't looking. And I would just sit there and think, and I can remember thinking this as a really young child, thinking, this is really out of perspective. Like, this is really unbalanced. Like, there's a man dying on a cross for somebody stealing a biscuit. It's just completely disproportionate. And my perception of sin was, I don't know quite why, but I just felt it didn't add up. And I remember being quite resentful, because I remember being aware that I didn't feel guilty enough. I knew that I didn't know how sinful I was, if that makes sense. But I remember feeling emotionally blackmailed by the church and actually quite resenting the church for it. I remember actually feeling guilty for not feeling guilty, if that makes sense. I was like, it's like they just want me to turn around and say that I'm terrible and I don't know how to do that. At the same time, the other thing that confused me about Sunday school and church was that although I understood intellectually what the gospel was, and on an intellectual level I did accept it, and for myself as well, I accepted it was true. I found this in my head, we were rewarded for things like works. So if we were really good in Sunday school, we would get loads of sweets. Or if we answered 20 questions right, we would be told, well done, you've answered 20 questions right. So it's really good to do well. But actually, it's really good to say you're a failure and that you're not very good at things because you're a sinner. That was how I perceived it. And again, to me, it was like there was an imbalance there. And I'm sure a lot of it was just my confusion. This isn't me sort of sitting here critiquing all my Sunday school teachers. I'm just being honest with you about how I felt at the time. It makes me cringe now to think of it. But I was honestly so proud that I truly believed that if I tried hard enough, I could keep all the Ten Commandments. So much so that I remember once being asked, you know, how people do in Sunday school when you learn about the Ten Commandments. And all the children, they were all much more clued up than me. They knew exactly what to do. and the teacher said, does anyone here think they can keep the Ten Commandments? And I put my hand up. And no one else did. And I looked around and I was like, okay, I better put it down again. I mean, that, you know, as I say, now I look back and I'm I cringe, but I think part of it was just that I thought we're supposed to really impress and do really well and know all the answers to Bible questions, so I thought I had to do that. So that was when I was quite little. But at the same time as all of this, I was starting, obviously, as obviously we all know that the older you get, the more you start to question whether you can trust what you've been taught. So it got to the point, I remember when I was about six, I thought, hang on a minute, I can't actually see God or hear him, so how do I know he exists? I remember having quite a deep conversation with my mum about this, and she said, well, yeah, you're right. You can't see God, you can't hear God, but it does say in the Bible that if you seek God, you will find him. If you want God to reassure you that he's really there, then you can just ask him, you know, you can just say, you know, help me to find you. And I do remember, my mum said to me later that she felt that that was a turning point. So I suppose in a very simple way, I did become a Christian then. But as you've probably gathered, there was still quite a lot of baggage and confusion over sin. And so I was very young spiritually in that area. I had a lot of learning to do. So by the time I got to age 11, I was quite confident and secure in the value of my own thoughts, as I said before. And this is where the whole knowledge wisdom thing comes in again. I suppose I would say I was spiritually confident in the intellectual truth of the gospel, if that makes sense. I could see it added up. I could see that because I was encouraged to talk about it a lot, and to listen to other people talk to me about it. But I was uncomfortably aware that my understanding of sin was lacking. And deep down, there was still that question in my mind, do I really get the depth of this? And I just sort of knew I didn't. And that was like an insecurity to me. When I was 11, we moved to Sweden for 6 months. And I think, if anything, that made me feel, that kind of probably contributed to even more to my independence as the oldest child. I was in a class with four other people. All my friends were from different countries. So quite an early age, we were quite enjoying. And those of you who've lived in lots of countries will know that some of you obviously much more, the more cultures you live in, the more it kind of broadens your thinking and your perspective on things. And then I moved back to the UK and I went to secondary school late, and I hated going to secondary school late. I absolutely hated it because I arrived a term late, and everyone else had made friends and kind of paired up. And I think that was the first time when I lost confidence and I suddenly really wanted to fit in, because I suddenly felt really insecure about the fact that I sort of wanted to be an original thinker. I wanted to sort of... I wanted to have my own say, if that makes any sense. But at the same time, obviously, as you get to be a teenager, you become increasingly aware that it's just not the done thing to stand up and just just suddenly start spouting out all this stuff that nobody else says. Everyone just thinks, what are you doing? And I think as I guess we all know, there's more pressure to fit in around the age. So I found that quite difficult. And I tried to handle it by just sort of quietened down. I was very, very quiet at secondary school. I just had a few close friends, but I didn't feel as confident to speak out as I had done when I was younger. And I think that was partly pride as well. I'm shutting this away if this is too difficult. And there weren't very many people my age at church at this time either. So I think that was more of a lonely time. And around this time, when I was 14, we went to a conference, which is actually where I met Tom. But at this point, there was definitely nothing going on. And he was 9 when I... So even more, you can see that there was definitely nothing going on. But I remember that there was a real turning point there, because I still had this insecurity. Although I accepted the intellectual truth of the gospel, I was happy to accept that I was a sinner and I needed feeling. I knew it didn't go as deep as it should. And I remember him saying, you know, are you sitting there thinking, have I really committed to Jesus? Have I actually accepted him? Have I really done that? Or am I just sort of floating around in this sort of mist of having been brought up by Christian parents? And I remember thinking, yeah, that's me. I am finding it really difficult to know at what point I became Christian. Am I for sure a Christian? And he said, just stop torturing yourself. Stop torturing yourself. Doesn't matter. He said, the important thing is, do you believe in Jesus Christ today? And I thought, yeah, I do, actually. So that was a turning point, even though, again, the baggage was still, you know, the stuff to do with sin still hadn't been there still was a lot to sort out there. When I was 15 or 16, I started to get doubts, and I thought, have I just been brainwashed? Is it just that I've been brought up like this? And again, I'm not going to go into that for too long because I'm a bit concerned that it might go on for ages otherwise. Speak to me afterwards if you want to know how I came through that. But I'll just tell you that I did come out the other end of that through, and I just want to say, to give tribute to all Christians who are much older and wiser than me for their patience in listening if people are going through doubts. It's just such a special gift from God, I think, when people have the patience to listen to you when you rant and rave about your doubts. I just want to pay tribute to all the friends and family who helped me with that. When I was 17, I decided to get baptised. And again, this issue of the sin popped up again. And again, I had that weird thing of feeling guilty for not feeling guilty enough, even though I knew that I wanted to be baptised and I wanted to say, yeah, that I've personally trusted in Jesus for my salvation. And I remember saying when I was 17 to God, okay, I'll get baptised. And I remember praying to him and saying, you know that I don't know how sinful I am. I remember saying to God, I know you know, but I just don't. And that's probably really bad, but I just don't get it. So please, can you show me? And looking back now, it's quite cringeworthy because I was probably just very arrogant and proud. But I remember just saying, please show me, because this I can see this. And I had no idea how he was going to answer that prayer. but I remember praying it. And it did start at that point where God showed me very gently, well, compare yourself to Jesus then, if you think you're so great. And of course, the minute you start comparing yourself to Jesus, the more you realise how completely fallen short you are. You know, Jesus, I was selfish and proud. Jesus was completely other-centred. I was intent on getting my own way a lot of the time. Jesus was really meek and submitted to the Father despite being God. And you could just go on and on, couldn't you? Once you start dwelling on Jesus's character, you've got nowhere to go. So I'd say that was definitely the point at which my understanding of my own sin started to deepen at 17, although there was still quite a long way to go, and I guess I will never get to the end of understanding it. I went abroad after I finished school, and I worked in Uganda for 6 weeks on a project with a Christian organisation called Reap International. Before that, I worked as a care assistant because I was just keen to do a bit of manual work, you know, get into the world of work for a bit. But I knew I wanted to go back and study at university, so I did that when I came back. And I studied music at York. So although I was still in York, I moved out and I lived on campus and in houses as a student. And I'm really grateful to God for this time. It was really nice actually hearing the students yesterday talk about their experiences at university. And I would really echo a lot of what they said yesterday, and that university is just such a great time to deepen in your faith, but also to be really challenged by lots of other minds and to have the opportunity to share the gospel with others. So I'm really grateful to God for putting me around lots of Christians, both mature and also Christians very different to me, so we were able to sharpen each other and to discuss things in great detail and at great length. And we all, my friends and I, used to love, I'm talking about non-Christians as well, I really enjoyed with my non-Christian friends talking about things like wisdom, you know, and again the wisdom knowledge thing, because I felt it was really important. I felt if my non-Christian friends wanted to know the truth, it had to stand up to scrutiny, that we had to have those conversations. So, you know, sometimes they would say, oh, you know, Emily, whatever the latest question was, if God is all powerful, surely he could make himself sin if he wanted to. How does that work? Just questions like that. And the more you have those sort of conversations, I think on one level, the more heartening it can be when you're like, yeah, this really is the truth. It really does stand up to scrutiny. So it was a time when, again, it felt like a time of blessing. It was a time when I was able to share the gospel with friends along with my fellow Christians. And I'm grateful that some of those non-Christian friends did become Christians and are still, in fact, one of them is a missionary now. And it's really lovely to see how God used that time. So yeah, I'm very grateful for that. After university, I went abroad to Zambia for 9 months. I should just say, I did want to say, I hope I'm not going on about this too much, but at university, although I don't in any way want to belittle or put down the importance of having those sort of conversations about the nature of God, how Christianity stands up to scrutiny. But I would like to confess that although I would have said it was mainly faith in God that was helping me answer those questions, and I am grateful to God for helping us all as Christians to have those conversations with our non-Christian friends, I can also see that I probably had quite a lot of confidence in my own mind and my own ability to answer those questions, and that more than I would have liked to think at the time, it was my mind in my own head giving me security. I had an idol in my mind at the time. I wouldn't have said that at the time, but I say it now looking back. So I did want to say that, and I hope it becomes clear why later. I came back after I'd been in Zambia for 9 months, doing again more missionary work, and I worked in York for a year, and this was just before I applied to start teaching in Cambridge, and around this time I started getting close to Tom. And I had known him for many years, and I had been in relationships before which didn't last, mainly because, if I'm honest, I enjoyed my independence too much. So I found it difficult. I think because as I said earlier, I did sometimes enjoy my own space. If it was really kind of private space, I often felt it was threatened if I got too close. But Tom was different, and for some reason I felt drawn to qualities in him that I lacked at quite a deep level. I really appreciated the fact that he was a good listener, and I was aware that I was someone who talked a lot and didn't listen enough, and I felt that he was someone who took in what people said. He didn't just tolerate people's conversation, he really listened, and that was something I really appreciated in him. And I also appreciated the fact that he was a thinker as well, but that he challenged my ideas, and I think I needed somebody to say, actually, what about this, and have you thought about this, and it says this, and all the rest of it. So that was actually uncomfortable. I wasn't expecting that. I thought I'd probably be one of those people who ended up single, to be quite honest, and I was happy with that. I was comfortable with that, and I was like, what's going on? This wasn't my plan. but I think God had other ideas. So to cut a long story short, it got to the point where Tom and I had been going out for a couple of years, and because we'd known each other for such a long time as well, and we were just very aware that we had a lot of the same outlook, and we felt that God wanted us to get married, we did. And we went into it knowing that we were relying on God's help and not on ourselves. And yet, we very quickly ran into trouble, and that's something that a more recent part of my life that's been very influential, and I need to talk about that. So although we loved each other, as I say, Tom and I very quickly ran into trouble after getting married, and a lot of the reasons for that were, so a lot of the things were outside of our control, but there were also things that were baggage that we hadn't dealt with, and I don't think we knew was there. And all of you who were married will know that when you go into marriage, sometimes you just have no idea what you're bringing in until it actually starts to work itself out. So we found ourselves in this incredibly unexpected place very quickly after getting married. And we really struggled to trust God, and we started to feel very bitter about this. And we also found ourselves under quite a lot of intense pressure at this point because Tom's dad, who had been a prominent missionary up to this point, and many people had been converted under him, also fell away, and Tom's parents broke up. So it kind of felt like everything fell apart at once. And I think probably because Tom and I, but I don't want to put words in Tom's mouth, but I think because we're both thinkers by nature, and we've both been brought up in a place where we thinking is like a security, you feel like you can depend on your family, they've brought you to where you are. It felt like all of that just fell under our feet, and it felt like it was completely untrustworthy. It was like everything just collapsed underneath us. And we were actually cracking under the strain of all of this when we moved to London and we started coming to APC. We did, and we went to speak to Gerard about it quite soon because I think we were aware we were going to have to. We said, look, I'm really sorry, but we're in the middle of this. And Gerard was very kind about it. Looking back, I believe that God deliberately put us into that melting pot. And I actually think he really deliberately gave us one trial after another, because he wanted to break us. And I know that might sound really strange, but there's nothing more comforting than it being God breaking you. because you just know that he's totally dependable. And there's nobody I'd rather give me a hard time than God. Now I look back and I see that there were so many things that we relied upon. There were earthly things. Even though we thought we were relying on God, actually there were so many earthly things that had to be burnt away. While we were still in the middle of it, and this is when we've moved to London, around this time, my old ally Wisdom came along. And I found myself thinking what I'd thought all up to this point. And I was like, you know, I've just got to think about this hard enough. You know, if I think about this hard enough, I can fix the problem. I can work out what's wrong. Because I'd always, again, just that whole thing of there's got to be a solution. There's got to be a big picture somewhere. I've got to just work out what it is. And as you can probably imagine, this just made it worse and worse. It just magnified everything. And I found suddenly my intellect and my brain were my worst enemy. And it was just awful. I started inventing problems as well as the ones that were already there. And poor Tom had to deal with half of that. Or all of it, probably, at various points. And I think sometimes you just don't know how sinful you are until you're put in a situation where you're under immense pressure like that. Then our marriage went into a full-blown crisis. So it actually just got worse. And a few of you here know about that and were really, really kind to us. And I'm really grateful to God that he provided me with a few close friends at APC who I could really pray through about these things. So we were really buckling under the pressure of the trials we'd been under and the sinful ways in which we'd both responded to them. And it actually got so awful from my point of view, where I'd got to the point where all of my thoughts, so completely different to university, that really kind of spiritually blossoming time where everything just fell into place and the jigsaw was complete and all my thoughts and emotions and everything just tied in with Christianity and it all made perfect sense. It was the absolute opposite in the middle of this crisis in our marriage. All my thoughts and feelings and emotions, it was like they were just screaming at me to go in one direction. And it was only God on the other side. And it was like a complete crossroads. And I just hated it because I was confronted with the fact that I'd made my mind and my emotions and my intellect into a massive idol. And I felt like God was telling me to go one way. And I wanted out. I wanted to get out the other way. And I felt so much in torment that I felt like the devil had hold of one side of me and God had hold of the other side of me and they were pulling me apart in this just awful tug of war. It was like I could feel the devil saying to me, you've always trusted your gut instinct, your own, your ability to judge situations, use your head, don't let God make your life miserable. You've analysed all the problems. You know that this marriage was a mistake. By this point, it just got really awful. God doesn't care. He didn't help you in your marriage in the first bit. Even though you tried to put him first and you tried to honour him, you believed it was right to get married. You trusted God to help you in your marriage. Look what he's done to you. He's just left you in a mess. Just get out. There's no point. So this was like when the marriage was like on the brink of breaking completely. And then the marriage really did break. And when it did, I was devastated. And it was like all of a sudden, too late, I just saw the folly of listening to earthly wisdom. And I suddenly realised that I was completely broken. I hadn't got any more wisdom to offer. My pride was completely shattered. I had no, there wasn't anything to be proud about. I didn't care anyway. It wasn't like pride came into it anymore. It just wasn't even a thing. And all I could feel was just this terrible loss of a beautiful thing that God had given us. And yet it was a weirdly liberating time as well. I actually felt freed. I know that might sound very odd. But even though I didn't know if God would put us back together when that happened, it was like the bottom of a world had pulled out from underneath me, but actually it was still there. And it was really odd. And it was the shape of a cross, that bottom. And I've just never been made more aware in my life of the ugly horror of my sin at that point. And yet the deep cleansing power of the cross in that moment. And I feel like, I mean, obviously I know I'm still speaking from the perspective of having more years to go. And I'm sure there's lots I still don't have a clue about. But all I can say is that I had no idea when I prayed that prayer at 17 that God would show me my sin, that I would be made to see more of the horror of it like that. And I remember Simon, it wasn't that long ago, Simon preached and he said in his sermon, we have no idea what God is protecting us from most of the time. When we go around with our facades and our masks, we just have no idea of the sin that's lurking inside us most of the time. And that I found that really moving, because I could say something that resonated with my experience in this. It was like seeing the most horrific monster inside. And suddenly, you know, as everyone here who's a Christian knows, you can't be grateful for the cross until you realise just how wretched you are. You just can't. I was just really grateful that God gave me a reassuring peace and said, yeah, okay, so you're in a big mess, but actually, do you know, I can go deeper than this mess, and I have already gone deeper than it. So, and that was very reassuring. So a lot of what I'm trying to say is that wisdom and knowledge, for all that it has a place, it just doesn't do anything in the end. It doesn't do anything for you. When you can't breathe, you don't analyse the oxygen mask and philosophise about it and muse over the pros and cons. You just grab it and put it on. And I couldn't breathe in this situation, so I grabbed Jesus. How is it I know that Jesus is real in my life? It's because he works. Yeah, I do firmly believe that people should discuss and question and inspect Christianity, because I'm a firm believer that the truth stands up to scrutiny. And Paul wasn't afraid to debate, was he? But you really know what matters when your life falls apart and it's all filth and mess, and you instinctively know that the world has no answer or solution to that mess. And the only person ever who's reached deep where no one else has reached is Jesus, and who has touched hearts where no one else has touched is Jesus. And not only that, but he's been raised from the dead. And the same power that raised him can live in you and me. And Tom and I can testify to that. And I think we're both pretty much in agreement that we just know that if God hadn't intervened, we wouldn't be married now. And it's God who has basically used, it's that resurrection power that's at work in our marriage. And we're not ashamed to say that, because we know we wouldn't make it on our own. So my understanding of what knowledge and wisdom is has changed. There was a time when I treasured understanding and insight above what the gospel has to offer. And now I feel that true knowledge and wisdom is to know Jesus in all his fullness. And I would trade that, any of my intellectual understanding of the gospel, I would trade that now. I would trade it and just say, I'm not bothered, just give me Jesus. I wish I could say I'm always thinking that, but I'm just saying, you know, at the best time, that's how it is for me. Your brain is important, and God did put it there for a reason, but even the mind has to bow the knee to God at some point and acknowledge its limitations, which we know are very great. Jared actually said, Jared and Mandy were very kind to Tom and me, and there were lots of other people as well, but I just want to say thank you again for that publicly. And there was something that Gerard said to me when we were in the middle of putting everything back together, which I think was just exactly what I needed to hear at the time. And it was just, when you're obeying, it doesn't actually, when you're obeying God, it doesn't actually matter how you feel about it. You just do it. And before then, I would have liked to say I did that, but I didn't. I liked to analyse things first and feel they made sense in my head, and then I would obey if it happened to fit with what my head thought. But actually, I found that really helpful, wisdom. And there are a lot of verses, aren't there, in the Bible, like the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So if you just forget the rest and you just get on with fearing God, then you learn what matters. And if we obey God with a trusting heart, our brains follow and become more wise. Thank you for being patient in listening to me. I just want to read a little bit from 1 Corinthians, because this passage has been really important to me. And then that'll be it after that. it's 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18 onwards. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many were influential, not many were of noble birth, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of the world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts boast in the Lord. So I just want to finish by saying that Christ Jesus is wisdom. Thank you.